Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Ranking of the Stars, a podcast in which I, Jack D'Lo Boblick, and my lovely, luscious, L.A. wildfire wife...
Oh, that's not funny.
...rip from the headlines.
Oh, my gosh. Hi, I'm Emmeline D'Lo Boblick.
Watch in chronological order every single movie that has won the Oscar for Best Picture, and this week's movie is...
The French Connection.
Alternate title, I Dreamed I Was a Cop.
Yeah.
And it was overwhelming.
It was.
Poster. It's a scene taken directly from the movie.
Yeah.
Where he shoots a guy, where Gene Hackman shoots a guy.
Yeah, but there's no context for I don't understand why this made it onto the poster.
Yeah, it's a really odd choice. Is this the iconic scene from the movie? It's a man being shot in the back with his arms raised and going, ah!
Yeah, there's a sort of a subtitle on it that says, the time is just right for an out-and-out thriller like this.
Sure. I would not call this movie a thriller. Would you?
I mean, that's how it's been classified.
Were you thrilled?
Definitely not.
You fell asleep, which is the opposite of being thrilled, yeah. I would say.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. What does that little blurb around Gene Hackman say?
Doyle is bad news, but a good cop. Mm,
yeah, he's a loose cannon, but he gets results. Sure, sure.
I don't know if that equates good cop, though.
No, I mean, well, good by the department's definition is he makes arrests and meets his quotas. So.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, this poster is not... In a movie so stuffed with melancholy visuals, the fact that they picked this scene to put on the poster is baffling.
I would have preferred if they had chosen, like, a steal from one of the car chases.
Yeah, the car chases are shit, man. They go across bridges like 20 times in this movie. Yeah. It's beautiful every time. Get one of the bridges.
Yeah.
The shots of the soaked streets and the neon in the puddles and the smoke coming out up out of the manholes. Any other throw a dart. Throw a dart in any other scene in this movie. You'd get a better one for the poster.
But it's one of the iconic scenes also in the movie.
I guess. He shoots that guy,
yeah.
And he falls backwards down the stairs. Is that the bar we have to clear for iconic?
I guess. Information about the movie?
And then we haven't even finished describing it. There's the title and the red letters against the white, and we got Gene Hackman on here twice. We get him twice for the price of one.
Yeah.
This poster sucks.
Yeah, for as, like, artsy as the movie is, like, they put all their budget in the movie and nothing into marketing.
Yeah, for what a masterful piece of moody cinema where every shot has been meticulously crafted, and then they just, like, slap the poster together in 5 minutes and called it a day.
Yeah.
Boo this poster.
Yeah, some intern was on it.
Yep.
Okay, so this is a 1971 American neo-noir action thriller movie.
I'll take the neo-noir.
Yeah.
I doubts on the action and thriller part.
Yeah.
There's some action.
I'm just with you.
It's very spaced out.
And every scene feels very, like, dragged out to the max.
Yes.
It's like, how many minutes can we have on this? 17? Okay, we'll take it.
It might be one of the most realistic police anything I've seen, because it lets you live in the drudgery that is trailing someone.
Right.
Where it's just walking around and following people forever and staying up in a car till 4 a.m.
But does that make it good entertainment, though?
Your mileage may vary.
It was directed by William Friedkin, and it's a story based on Robin Moore's novel of the same title from 1969.
This is based off a book?
Yeah.
Man, I'm curious about what the novel's like, because there's so...
But it's also based on real events.
Oh, okay, it's a novel based on real... A movie based on a novel that's based on real events.
Yes.
Okay. The board game, the movie, the donut.
Everything.
The themed cafe.
It was produced by Philip Denteny Productions and Shinemore Productions, and it was distributed by 20th Century Fox. The release date was October 7th, 1971. The running time is 104 minutes.
Blessedly short.
Yes, thank God. The movie contains dialogue in English and French.
Though I would say there's not a single piece of spoken dialogue in this movie that is clearly understandable.
Yeah, at least the first 15 minutes it was hard.
I think that is a recurring problem throughout the entire film, that everyone has mush mouth.
Yeah, but after some time, I'd say you kind of get used to their accent and then the way they're talking. I don't know. That's how it was for me. It took me some time to just get used to the way they were talking.
Less the accent for me and more the fact that it's one of those movies where everyone in every scene is all talking at once all the time.
Yeah.
So they don't do the thing in movies where everybody gets a turn to talk. It's like real life where everybody's talking at once and it's a fucking mess.
Yeah. The budget at the time was $1.5 million, but they went over budget by $300,000. And the movie made over $75 million if you count box office and rentals.
Yeah, this is another one where they didn't have to build any sets. It's just them going around New York.
Yeah.
They didn't even pay to clean up any of the places they went. They left all the garbage right where it was.
Most likely, yeah.
Realism. I love it. This empty Burger King bag. It's art.
Did you actually see a Burger King bag, or is
no,
it just some?
But there was
the
so
first
much
thing that came into your mind.
First came into mind. There was plenty of just soda cups and fry bags and shit on the street. It's in there somewhere. I'm sure of it.
So it is based on two real life narcotics detectives.
Oh boy.
Named Eddie Egan and Sonny Grosso.
Sonny Grosso.
Yep. In the movie, they are portrayed by Gene Hackman, who plays Detective Jimmy, or Popeye Doyle.
Yeah, I call him Popeye in the synopsis.
And Roy Scheider, who plays Detective Buddy Cloudy Russo.
Who's his partner, who I just refer to as Partner.
Partner.
Because I don't think they ever say his name in the movie.
They call him Buddy sometimes, but not many times.
Yeah, they have a lot of pet names for him, but everyone has a different pet name for him. So I don't, what his actual name is never clarified.
Right. The big guy that they're, big bad guy that they're pursuing is a French heroin dealer named Alain Charnier, or he's called Frog One in the movie, and he's played by Fernando Rey.
I refer to him as the Longshoreman.
The Longshoreman.
The Longshoreman, because that's what his wife calls him.
Yeah, that's right.
Looks a little bit like Alan Rickman. A little bit.
A tiny bit.
He got a little whiff of it. Whiff of the Rickman.
Yeah. Other characters include Salvatore Bocca, or he's called Sal.
Yep, Sal.
Also, he's played by Tony LoBianco. We also have Henry Devereaux, who's played by Frederick de Pascal, and Angie Bocca, who's played by Arlene Farber.
Who appears
a couple of times.
Once in the movie and says maybe one line of dialogue. Henry is also the only character who is called by his proper name in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Everybody else is, Popeye or Buddy or...
Henry Devereaux.
Yep.
All right. No relations to Blanche Devereaux.
No, unfortunately. The Golden Girls crossover we all wanted.
But didn't get. Fun facts. So there is a documentary-like quality to this movie. And the director said that this was done on purpose, and it was the result of his admiration and influence that he got from watching a French movie called Z by Costas Gavras.
I feel like we've had that on the runners up at some point. Z feels sounds familiar.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
You have
which
no.
Is doing, I've never seen it, so I have no idea. For I've sure. learned the. I've heard the name Costas Gavras before, but yeah, never watched Z. There were other actors considered for the lead role, but some of them, including Paul Newman, were way too expensive and out of budget range. Actually, I read that Paul Newman's fees would have exceeded the whole movie budget.
Yep.
So, not an option.
The beginning of Gene Hackman's career, so he was cheap.
Yeah. So, amongst the other actors that were considered, we find Steve McQueen, Lee Marvin, James Caan, Robert Mitchum, but not Marlon Brando.
I wasn't going to say it this time. But you put it in there.
I put it in there because I knew it was going to come.
We're going to see him this decade, though. In the Godfather? The Godfather.
That would be the next movie we're watching.
It is?
Yeah.
Shit.
I think in this decade we have both Godfather 1 and Godfather 2.
Oh, boy.
Yep.
Those are going to be long ones, Christ.
Yes. Yep. All right, the guy who plays the French heroin dealer, Fernando Reyes, his casting in the movie was completely accidental because Friedkin was looking for another actor he had seen in a movie, but he didn't know that actor's name. He just knew that the actor was Spanish. So he contacted that film's casting director asking for the Spanish actor's contact.
The Spanish guy, you know, the only Spanish guy.
And the casting director then contacted Ray. Eventually they all realized that it was a mistake. But the actor that Friedkin had in mind didn't speak French or English. So they turned towards Fernando Ray because he had those abilities. He could speak French and English.
Fernando Rey was who? Is he the guy who gets shot in the beginning?
He's Alain Charnier. He's the guy in France. He's the drug dealer.
The drug dealer. Oh, he's
Frog One.
He's Frog One. The Alan Rickman. All right. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
The movie centers on drug smuggling. And in real life, in the late 60s, early 70s, that's at the peak of when heroin was illegally imported on the East Coast. And the biggest bust occurred on April 26, 1968, when 246 pounds of heroin were discovered in a car named Citroën DS, which to me is like the most classic car that represents France. And overall, over the years, that very car had been used to smuggle a total of 1,606 pounds of heroin into the United States.
That type of car or that one?
No, no, no. That one specific car.
Damn.
That one specific car. When they finally made an arrest on the whole operation, somebody in the guys that they arrested revealed that that specific car was used to smuggle heroin in, and that over the years it had brought like 1,606 pounds of heroin into the country.
Yes, we call this the heroin mobile. You yeah. get high just from driving it.
Is that your French accent?
Oui.
Oui.
The golden age of heroin, they called it.
Yep. Exactly. There were lots of iconic locations in the movie, such as Fifth Avenue, Columbia Heights. There's a restaurant called Le Copain, or like in French it would be like the friend or the buddy.
Where we just get to watch him eat snails for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, and it's a real restaurant. It's on First Avenue.
It still exists?
I think so. There's Dover Street near the Brooklyn Bridge and some international locations like the restaurant La Samaritaine, which is in Old Town Marseille in France. And I know this location, like I've been there once. I haven't been to the restaurant, but I've been like in that neighborhood. And yeah, I was not nostalgic, but it was cool to see it in a movie.
Yeah. shockingly small amount of France in a movie called The French Connection.
Yeah. So the movie was well received when it was released. It got 8 Academy Award nominations, including Best Supporting Actor for Roy Scheider, Best Cinematography, and Best Sound.
I agree with the first one, not the second one necessarily. The soundtrack in this movie is aggressive. It assaults you.
Yeah. There's no silence.
No.
Ever. It won 5 Academy Awards for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Gene Hackman, Best Screenplay Based on Material from Another Medium, and Best Film Editing.
I agree with all that.
Yeah.
Without seeing the other movies that got nominated. So maybe not Best Picture, but Gene Hackman was fine.
Yeah.
Sure. Film editing, great, yeah. Strongest part of this whole thing, the editing,
yeah,
the cinematography.
And the loser's bracket for 1971 includes A Clockwork Orange.
Thank God we dodged that bullet.
You've read the book, right?
I started.
Or you started it.
It is one of the rare books I have not finished because it was so... it's one of those ones where they make up their own language and there's a lot of slang in it and people talking in slang, and it's a chore to get through for me.
All right.
I made it about 10 pages, I think.
Okay, that bad. Mm-hmm. Wow. Fiddler on the Roof, The Last Picture Show, and Nicholas and Alexandra.
I'll take The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, why not?
Movies that are just people's names. Does nothing for me.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't give you, if you don't know anything about it, it just doesn't give you anything to go on to imagine what it could be about.
Nope. Yep, that's some people's names. Tells me nothing. Synopsis.
Let's go.
This might be the shortest one I've ever done.
I think so.
Comes in at 5 pages on Microsoft Word, which is 3 pages when printed out double-sided. There's just reducing what actually happens in the scenes in this movie down to, you know, what actually happens. Not much happens. This movie is mostly about the cinematography and just looking at the stuff.
It's mostly, like you said at the beginning, it's mostly following the characters, almost like you're shadowing them. You're making a documentary about what it's like to be a cop.
Yeah, it takes 5 seconds to describe what happens and then 10 minutes to watch because they linger so long on everything.
Yeah.
They want to show you every storefront and every piece of smoke coming up and every piece of garbage blowing by. And just, you know, this movie is an aesthetic traffic jam, I called it, and I stick by it. The movie opens by assaulting us with loud banging and screeching horns as plain white credits appear over a black background. Just very abrasive trumpets. And then some like drums like dong, dong, dong. Just beat you over the head as soon as it comes on. It abruptly stops and we find ourselves in Marseille watching a man eat some bread as he walks the garbage-strewn streets. Everywhere is dirty.
Yeah, that's Marseille.
He leans against a pole and watches two men in suits get into a car. Then we cut to the man sitting at a cafe and smoking. Then more walking through narrow back alleys. And you get all these beautiful shots of the city. It's a waterfront city.
Yeah.
So you get to see the docks and the boats and all the colorful houses. It's like sloping downward. It's like a city built on a hill. It's got that nice curve to it. The cafe he's sitting at, there's like a trolley going by. There's just so much visual detail in every scene in this movie. It is overwhelming.
I'm glad that they... I don't know if Marseille was historically accurate, but I'm glad that they chose Marseille and not Paris, because it was... I don't like Paris very much. So
bunch of snobs.
It was nice to see a different city for once.
Yeah, there's other places in France, you know. It's not all just the Eiffel Tower. Next cut sees him coming out of a store holding a baguette and then entering a door and checking a mailbox, only to be interrupted by a man pointing a gun at him. He stares at the gun with a blank expression and then is shot dead. You get just a brief close-up of his face and some, like, ketchup gets thrown on it. Bang! And then he falls over.
Yep.
Dead. The gunman tears a chunk off the baguette after stepping over the corpse and walks away. What does this have to do with the rest of the movie?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. I mean, we see the hitman, which I did not realize until the second viewing that the guy who kills him in the beginning is the guy who comes to America with the longshoreman.
Oh.
Yep. That's him.
Yeah, that just wasn't clear.
Who is also the guy who Gene Hackman has the car chase when he gets onto the train. He's mm-hmm. falling. It's all the same guy. I did not figure that out until the second viewing.
Nope.
Jump to Brooklyn, where a bunch of kids are hanging around a man dressed as Santa outside the Oasis Bar and Grill. They start to sing Jingle Bells, and a man getting a hot dog nearby takes that as his signal and enters the bar. He pushes through the crowd, which is all black people. There is some racial stuff in this movie that the movie has absolutely zero interest in examining or thinking about.
It feels so random.
Well, I mean, it's probably accurate to the time.
Sure, it's but just, the movie has no interest in explaining or dealing with it any further than just showing it.
Yeah, there's almost no explanation of anything in this movie. You're really just tossed into the deep end, and the movie has no interest in helping you figure it out. Yep. It's just, it stands there and watches you flail about and shrug its shoulders and go, sink or swim. So he enters into this bar. He's a white guy in a bar full of black people. And he picks one man out and roughs him up and pats him down, reminiscent of the beginning of In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah.
When the officer comes in for Mr. Tibbs and just shoves him against the wall and is patting him down, and treating them less than human. He doesn't find what he wants and shoves that man into a phone booth and blocks it with a chair. As he does so, the bartender makes a run for it, and the cops give chase, joined by the guy dressed as Santa, who is then revealed as Gene Hackman.
Yes.
Gene Hackman was Santa. Yeah, this movie bizarrely, just for no reason, takes place around Christmas. Like, there's a lot of Christmas lights and displays in the shop fronts and stuff. It has nothing to do with the plot. It's just, that's the time of year it happens around. They briefly corner the bartender in an alcove, but the bartender pulls a knife and they back off enough for him to push through and keep running. They chase him through the city until he falls in an abandoned lot full of garbage, and they fall on him with kicks and punches, and the camera stays back, so you just see them at a distance just beating the shit out of this guy. Yeah. From there, they drag him to another empty lot between two buildings that is also full of garbage, but with the added bonus of a cozy fire. It's just... one of the patches of the ground is just on fire. Just no reason, no explanation. They push the bartender up against the wall and scream at him to tell them who his supplier is. And Popeye also takes the opportunity to ask if he still picks his feet like he did in Poughkeepsie. You pick your feet in Poughkeepsie. And this is from the very beginning. Just everybody's talking over each other. You can't understand a damn thing they're saying to this guy. It's all just Marvel. Like, ah, fuck you. Who's your supplier? Where to go? I don't know nothing, man.
Yeah, and he repeats that phrase multiple times. Like, pick your feet in Poughkeepsie.
Yeah,
and the only thing I could figure out from that phrase at first was just Poughkeepsie.
Poughkeepsie. Yeah, it's a real sticking point for him, and comes up multiple times in this movie. This whole picking your feet in Poughkeepsie thing.
But you have no idea why. There's no reference for it. It's a madness.
Yeah, it's just non sequitur after non sequitur in this movie. And you look at the movie and say, well, why is any of this happening? And then the movie looks back and says, fuck you, that's why it's happening. And then we go to the next scene. So he'll nail him for picking his feet in Poughkeepsie, and also for cutting his partner's hand when the knife, he was flinging the knife around, he goes, you cut my partner's hand. He's going to be complaining about his bowling scores for a week, so I'm going to take you down to prison for the drugs and cut my partner's hand and for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie. Then we're back in France as the longshoreman arrives at an oceanside villa with a present. He's soon greeted by his wife, who takes the present and opens it, revealing it to be a camera.
I wasn't sure if it was his wife or his daughter at first, because she's much younger. She looks much younger than him.
Yeah, he's got some salt and pepper in his goatee, but she is just a young, vivacious redhead.
Yes.
Yep. Wife, same last name. We only know that from the credits. No one's name in this entire movie is ever said. But he gives her a camera, which has nothing to do with anything, and then she runs inside to get his present, which turns out to be a heavy winter coat, because it is cold in America,
she said. It looks like a fur coat.
Yep. On the inside, not one of the ones that has the fur on the outside.
Yeah.
It's the fur inner lining. And then he says, without you, I would still look like a longshoreman, which is why he's called the longshoreman. Then we're back with Popeye and partner as they get some drinks at an upscale bar where women are singing about going to the moon. And this is, you get to hear this song for a good 5 minutes. It's ladies in bright sequin dresses and their, like, bebop haircuts and just singing about going to the moon. Isn't it wonderful that we're the generation that gets to touch that bright, shiny orb? And it's a bar full of people in suits and ladies with their pearls and smoke everywhere. Popeye wanders around talking to various people and smooching ladies, but then finally comes to rest and stares daggers at a certain table full of people who are very clearly in the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
They're all wearing suits. They're all smoking cigars. They've all got slick back hair.
Yeah, and not to, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, stereotype them or anything, but they all look like they could be from Italy.
They're Italian.
Yes.
How dare you?
Yes.
His partner is also at the bar, and he tells his partner he knows some of the people at that table, and his partner replies he thought they were just going out for drinks. Pie suggests they tail one of the guys from the table just for fun. Why? Asks his partner. You want to play hide the salami with his old lady? Popeye thinks for a moment and then says, yeah. Our heroes in this movie are both gross and juvenile.
Yeah.
Which is completely accurate, I'm sure, to cops.
I mean, not all cops, but...
cops in this place, in this era.
Yeah.
It's all, they're frat boys.
Yeah.
Basically. Before, when he even asks his partner if he wants to go out for a drink, and he's like, I'm not thirsty, and then he just, like, makes a jacking off motion with his hand. It's just that forever and for always. It's all sex jokes, and, you would bang the lady, and, dicks and balls, and they never mentally progress past the age of 12.
Yeah, I mean, they're guys who are obviously single also.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Terminally single. And
you understand why.
Yes. And if you talk to them about it, they'd be, your broad's always trying to bring you down. So then we cut to Popeye and partner loitering in a dark parking lot, waiting for the mob guys to come out of the bar, and following them in their car through the neon-soaked streets once they do. We then cut to 7 a.m. the next morning as Popeye's partner complains that he can't believe they've been following this guy all night. As said guy exits a bar called Ratner's and the Jaws music plays. Very reminiscent of the dun-dun, dun-dun, but slightly off from that. They continue to follow him and finally see him do something suspicious. He takes a briefcase up to someone's door and drops it off. Has to be drugs. Has to be. We then get more scenes of driving over bridges and through industrial areas, because anytime they get in a car in this movie, you're going to get long, extended scenes of just them driving. And to be fair, they do a lot with the camera in those scenes. Yeah. Like, you'll get scenes from the car's perspective. You'll get from behind the bumper. You'll get just, like, the tires passing by on the road. You'll get, like, the camera right outside the passenger window, so you're looking in through the windows at them. Yeah. They do a lot with it. A lot of really nice bridge shots, too, like I said before. The sun setting as they cross over bridges through the traffic. Spend a lot of time in traffic in this movie. And then they see the mob guy change cars. They follow him to a cafe, and we cut back to the longshoreman as he gets off a small boat near a castle and picks an ocean potato out of a puddle to eat. Do you know what the fuck that was? He gets off a boat, there's a puddle on the dock.
Yeah.
And there's, like, they look like sweet potatoes. in the puddle, and he just bends down.
No, he had to open it like an oyster.
He bends down, he takes the sweet potato out of the puddle, and he just starts fucking eating it. It's gross.
He had to, he takes it in his hand, and then he has a knife, and he has, he opens it, and then he's like swallows it like you swallow an oyster.
I cannot imagine the amount of money you would have to pay me to just pick something up out of a puddle on the street and eat it. Is this acceptable in France? Are you all a bunch of animals like this?
Well, you already called me pervert most of the time, so I guess that fits.
You think it was an oyster, that what it was?
I think so.
Okay.
Because I definitely saw him like have a knife, and then he's twisting the knife in like the crevice to open the thing. So, and he makes that gesture where you like, what would you call it?
Pour it back?
Yeah, he pours it back in his mouth. So.
All right. All right.
I thought that's what that was.
Who doesn't love a good sidewalk oyster?
Yeah.
One of the most insane things we've seen anyone do in any of these movies. Mm. So he then climbs the stairs onto the castle walls, where he meets the hitman who killed the guy in the opening.
Right.
The hitman says it's a mistake to get this new guy involved, and the longshoreman replies, "A mistake? It's inspired. He's a TV star. A celebrity. Wherever he travels, he does so for free." And this is all in French, of course. The hitman still doesn't trust him. The man they're talking about then arrives and introduces himself as Henry Devereaux and says he's decided to accept. Accept what? Fuck you, that's what. Back in America, we're told the mob guy they were tailing is Salvatore Bocca. They call him Sal, and he's been picked up before on suspicion of armed robbery. He tried to rob Tiffany's in broad daylight, but they didn't press charges. His old lady is named Angie. She's a fast filly who drew a suspension for shoplifting a year ago. She's 19, according to the marriage license. Sal has owned the store for a year and a half, and it brings in about $7,000 a year. "How can he afford two cars and nights out at a fancy bar, then?" asked Popeye. "Well, the first car is in his wife's name, and the second is in his brother Lou's name, who is a trainee in the garbage man school on Ward's Island." And then we get some scenes of him on Ward's Island training to be a garbage man.
I didn't know that there was such a thing as garbage man school.
I would imagine that if you're in some rural town, it's as easy as just fucking putting it in the truck. But if you're in New York, it might be slightly more complicated.
Sure.
Yeah. About what is and is not trash, because everything is trash everywhere. So what am I allowed to put in the truck? Because everything here is garbage. So Lou, the garbage man, did time for assault and robbery a couple years ago. All this over various scenes of the pair tailing people around the city, both on foot and in cars. Then we have another bar scene where Popeye shakes down everyone in the place, yelling and screaming and asking more people if they pick their feet. It's another bar where it's all black people,
yeah.
And he goes in and just starts screaming at people, makes them all get up against the wall, and then he just starts, it's a bar with a lip on it.
Yeah.
And so he just runs his hand underneath the lip, and like every 2 inches, like, pulls out another bottle of pills or more drugs or something. They got, like, an entire damn pharmacy stash in there. It's ridiculous. And he just puts it all on the bar. Then at some point he asks who wants a milkshake, and he just puts all the drugs he found into a cup and shakes it up.
It's like, if you combine everything together, there's a bus to be made, but everything on its own is probably not enough to arrest anyone.
No, he's not actually interested in any of it.
No.
Like, he makes one arrest, I think, from people who were there, seemingly at random, because everybody in that place had drugs on them.
Yeah.
He's just throwing his weight around and trying to get information, really. He makes a couple of arrests and then pulls one guy in particular into the bathroom. This guy, like, comes out from the back like he wasn't in there when he put everybody else against the wall. He's like, "Hey, why are you still walking around? Get in the fucking bathroom. Come here." And the guy's like, "Why are you picking on me, man?" But then as soon as they get into the bathroom, it is revealed that that particular guy is an informant.
Is he an informant, or is he also, like, a narcotics cop?
That's not the vibe I got It's hard to tell who is and isn't a cop in this movie because no one ever shows their badge.
I thought maybe he was an undercover.
I think he's just an informant because if he was undercover, I think they'd catch on eventually to that. I think maybe. That's harder to do than just being a rat. Whatever the case is, they're fighting into the bathroom, and then as soon as the door closes, just like, all right, man, what's going on? And he's like, I haven't heard anything. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but he does that like classic thing at the end of their conversation before they get out. Like, he gives him an actual punch.
Yeah.
I feel like you wouldn't be able to do that when just an informant.
I mean, Popeye is not friendly to anyone. He's a very violent man.
Yeah, but the other guy like agrees to it. He was like,
You don't want to blow your cover.
Sure. That's why I'm thinking that he's most likely like an undercover cop.
Who can say? Not even the movie can tell us.
Yeah.
We would have to read the novel. Popeye asks the informant informant/undercover cop about Sal, and the guy doesn't know anything. Before they go back out, Popeye punches him to make it look convincing. He at least asks the guy where he wants it.
Yeah.
Which side he wants it on. It's like, this side, I guess. And then he punches him. And then they go back out fighting. Like, oh, fucking hell. Like, come on, man.
It's such a cliche move. Like, I've seen it before in TV series and other movies. Like, where do you want it? Mm. And the guy, I was like, what are they talking about? But he knew exactly what's going to happen.
They've done the song and dance before. It's not their first rodeo. Like, oh, man, every time Popeye comes here, he punches you in the face. Mm. From there, we move to the police station as Popeye argues with his chief, who sounds like Bill Burr. About whether Sal is really actually up to something or Popeye is just being paranoid because his hunches have backfired before. Every year, Popeye leads the narcotics department in arrests, but what does he bring in? A junkie in shorts? A kid with a joint in his sock? The arguing continues, and the chief eventually gives in, asking what Popeye will need. What he needs is two wires, one on the store, one on the house. The chief reluctantly agrees, and as Popeye leaves, he asks Popeye if he still picks his feet. This is a recurring thing in the police station, I guess. Just in the police force. This picking your feet in Poughkeepsie. And this guy really sounds like Bill Burr.
He's
got the exact same accent. And then there's this board of like paraphernalia behind them, which is like all the different kind of like crack pipes and stuff. But they have it set up like a display case. Like, it reminded
me... Like we're in a museum?
Yeah, it reminded me of the way that people set up those boards of, like, pinned butterflies. But it's all, like, crack pipes and drug paraphernalia. You know, they're trophies from their hunt.
We're in the narcotics.
Yep. We then cut to Henry standing on the near the railing of a boat, surrounded by reporters with the New York skyline in the background. After a few inane questions like, do you agree that the mayor of New York is the sexiest man in America? And like that kind of dumb shit. Because Henry's an actor.
Yes.
He's supposed to be a French actor. We jump to the shore as his car is hoisted out of the ship as the longshoreman and the hitman watch. From an elevated position, they're just standing up like on a crane somewhere, just like watching the car be taken out of the belly of the ship. Then we're back at the police station as the chief tells Popeye's partner that the judge gave them 6 months to find something on Sal. He's also adding a new cop named Bill to the case. Bill isn't happy about it and remarks that Popeye's hunches have cost a good cop his life before, but that's just his opinion. Popeye's partner tells him to shove his opinion up his ass. Bill is like, he's out of shape, balding, the classic cop near retirement.
Yeah.
Who, like, he cares a little bit, but not much.
Yeah, exactly, because he knows he's close to the end, so.
Yeah, but doesn't like Popeye, because Popeye got another cop. We never get any details about, they reference it multiple times. We are never told how he got this other cop killed. So Popeye's partner tells Bill to shove his opinion up his ass, and the chief pleads with Bill to just give Popeye a chance. He's a good cop, he says. He's like, you got any problems, just come to me. Just don't make a big deal out of it. It'll be okay. It'll be fine. Just everybody be calm. The police chief, we don't see very much of him, but he looks like he's 40 going on 60. because of the stress from his job. Yeah. Like, he's prematurely, like, graying, and he's just completely stressed out, like, constantly smoking cigarettes and just on the verge of having a nervous breakdown, it seems like, always.
I mean, I get that.
Oh, yeah.
The being, being in the police must be stressful, but anywhere. Being in the narcotics.
In New York?
Especially, yeah.
Just, yeah, constant, never-ending stress.
And plus, he's supervising people like Popeye. Yeah. They're a little bit too zealous sometimes, and you're like, what the fuck am I getting into every day when I get up?
And like, shit, man, you can't fire him because then you don't have cops, so.
Yep.
Cut to Popeye walking up, waking up in a bar and blearily stumbling out into the morning light. We get that that cut from, he's a good cop, and then we just cut to him and he's like waking up in a bar because he's fallen asleep on the counter. He's been there all night. He stumbles out into the morning light and gets into his car. On the drive home, he sees a woman in front of him wearing bright red boots and riding a bike. And was it trying to imply with a shot that he was staring at her ass?
I think so.
I don't think it didn't.
I thought so.
It didn't focus on her ass as much as other movies do when they're trying to show you that somebody's oogling somebody else. But
yeah, but she's dressed in a way that attracts the eyes to her butt.
Betraying the sisterhood. She was dressed like a whore.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that she was dressed in a way that attracted eyes to her butt.
Yeah. Tight-fitting, I would say, to her feet with those bright red boots. Like rain boots. It was weird. Another cut takes us back to Popeye's partner as he knocks on the door of Popeye's apartment and is told to let himself in because Popeye can't open the door right now. Mm. And I want to pause for a second and just talk about how I'm glossing over so much visual detail in the synopsis by talking about the detail in the scene where what actually happens is the partner walks up and knocks on a door, right?
Yes.
But what you're seeing in the movie, the hallway he walks down, the way they position it at the end of the hallway and have him just walking towards the camera, mm-hmm. and it's these bright, like, yellow tiles. It's even just such a mundane action has so much visual splendor to it in this movie. Yeah. Feels very like a very antiseptic kind of place, like it's almost like a hospital hallway or something with how overly clean it is compared to everywhere else in the movie, and the tiles just filling up the entire screen and just having a person just walk through this overwhelming yellow space.
Yeah.
Just if I tried to describe what every scene actually looked like, this podcast would be 6 hours long. Mm. But there's a few I've picked out, like this one here when he's in the hallway, to try and give you an idea of all the other stuff I'm glossing over. So the partner enters, knocking over a bicycle as he does so, and the camera immediately points at the floor, showing a pile of women's clothes complete with bright red boots. It then pans slightly to the left to reveal Popeye's foot handcuffed to his sofa bed. He tells his partner to hand him the keys for the cuffs and his pants, and gets dressed while his partner tells him that he got the warrants for Sal, but also picked up two feds as well. And it was at that point in the rewatch that I realized that there were two feds in this movie. I just thought that they were Bill, that other guy that was with them. But there's two other separate characters who are federal agents.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until I was doing the notes for the podcast either, like, because they're listed in the cats as FBI agents. Yeah.
Yeah, they have names, but I don't think they have a single line of dialogue between them in the entire movie. From there, we move to an auto graveyard where the longshoreman and his wife go into a shipping container where an auction of repossessed cars is taking place. They also, when he's in the apartment, his partner sees the lady, and she's got no clothes on. We get another butt. And I would also like to point out that all the naked women we've seen so far in this project have been running away from the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, we can't look directly at it yet. We have to, like, gaze through the keyhole almost. It's always voyeuristic and very quick.
Well, it's also in that way, it very much reflects the way that movies are looking at women, but also society is looking at women. They're just bodies, and if you saw their faces, then they're a person, but she's just meant to be a body here.
You're right. I didn't think about not seeing the face aspect. I was thinking about the just, like, how it's always so quick, and, like, mm-hmm. it doesn't linger on it. It's just, it's almost like it's ashamed of it. Like, oh, it's there, but you see it out of the corner of your eye, and then you turn your head away quickly.
Oh, I don't read it like that. I read it more as just, she doesn't contribute anything to the story, so
yep.
It's quick because she doesn't matter.
Yeah, just throwing an ass at you.
Yeah. it has to be, this movie is for a supposedly, like, thriller. It's mostly boring, so in that you're taking offense. In that moment, you gotta have a little bit of excitement, so adding, like, not even 5 seconds of butts.
Not even a full second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That can be exciting.
Yep. Wake up the audience just so you can put them back to sleep.
Yeah.
All right, so we're in this auto graveyard, which is another cool visual place, because it's an actual car graveyard with just, like, to the horizon, just wrecks and all kinds of old cars and stuff. And then they go into a shipping container to have the auction. It's such a claustrophobic, confined space, just stuffed full of people. And a third Frenchman points out Sal's garbage man brother in the shipping container in the auction crowd and says that that's their buyer. Buyer for what? Fuck you. And we get the classic auction thing of, like, 25, 25, gonna get 25. Do I hear 26, 26, 26 for 27. Once, twice, sold to the gentleman. Then we're back with Popeye and partner as they play cards, as they listen to the wire they had planted in Sal's shop and laugh about the argument they hear between Sal and his wife about getting pizza. Get a pizza on your way home. And he's like, what pizza place is gonna be open at 2 a.m? I'll just try. And this is the peak of comedy for Popeye and his partner. This is hilarious. It's a real knee slapper.
Yeah.
Sometime later, they overhear Sal being invited to a hotel for a meeting, and they both yell in celebration. It was, I think, this scene that solidified just what a clusterfuck visually every scene in this movie is, because even just the little room they're in listening to the wire, like, there's cards all over the table, they've got paper they're writing on just fucking everywhere. It's just a mess. Every scene of this movie is a mess. They didn't clean up anything. There's just junk and messy desks and trash everywhere. The cigarettes they've been smoking, their empty beer cans. Even more later, they trail Sal's car over a bridge with Bill in the back seat, who asks Popeye if Popeye still wears his gun around his ankle. And we know that he does, because in that scene where he was putting his pants on after the lady, we see him strap his gun around his ankle.
Yeah.
Popeye ignores him, and Bill continues that he heard it's because when he rubs up against a chick, he doesn't want her to know he's a cop. But I don't believe that. I think it's some sort of quick draw method, says Bill. Partner tells Bill to knock it off. Then they get caught in traffic, and Popeye jumps out of the car and runs ahead, trying and failing to keep an eye on Sal. As Popeye curses and pounds the hood of his car, his partner reaches another cop on the radio, who just spotted Sal driving past him. So they don't lose him. This leads to an extended sequence of Popeye and his partner following Sal on foot through New York. At some point, they see him talking to the longshoreman, and Popeye tells his partner to keep following Sal while he follows the new guy. We get a bunch of these trailing scenes. It's just them walking through crowds in New York, and you get to see a bunch of, like, storefronts and 70s fashion and stuff, so it's entertaining from that perspective. But man, is it just a lot of, like, walking behind people and, like, trying to glance at them out of the side of your eye and, like, oh, did he notice me? I'm gonna hold this newspaper and, like, try and look over it without being noticed. And just that for long stretches of the movie.
It's uncomfortable. It's really, I don't know, it's just so obvious in some of the scenes that they're cops and they're trailing someone, but they're trying not to be obvious, but by trying not to be obvious, they're even more obvious.
Yep.
To me, I was always on the edge, just waiting for them to be discovered by the people that they were trailing.
On the edge. You were thrilled, you would say.
No. I was just waiting for something to go wrong.
Yeah. I did not get that feeling at all. I never felt like they were about to be discovered or anything. Mm. It just... I mean, they're aware that they're being tailed, but they're not going to, like, have a confrontation out in the street. So I always felt like, oh, the most they're going to do is try and lose them.
Yeah.
The longshoreman eventually makes his way into a fancy French restaurant, and Popeye stands across the street and watches him eat multiple courses of French delicacies while talking to mobsters. We just get, like, a five-minute... sequence of this guy just eating snails and eating delicate meats, yeah. And while Popeye just stands out in the cold, and like I get the juxtaposition of the criminal being in luxury and the cop being out in the elements, but it's a criticism that can be leveled at every scene in this movie. Is like we didn't need 5 to 7 minutes of this to make the point. And at some point Popeye's partner comes with coffee, but the coffee's bad, so Popeye just dumps it out on the sidewalk. He's also making zero attempt to hide himself.
Yeah, he's like literally just like right across the street from them.
He's right across the street. You can see him out of the window that's right next to the longshoreman.
Yeah.
There's no one else around, so he sticks out. He's just like staring across the street, staring directly into the window. Like, no attempt to hide himself. Later, after the sun has set, Popeye walks the darkened streets, still on the prowl, and then we get this really beautiful shot of him walking in front of this blue shop front.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that? It's just blue lighting, so it's just him silhouetted against the blue background. It's really beautiful. His partner then pulls up in a car, and Popeye gets in, giving his report on what he's learned, which is pretty much nothing. He asks what the feds are up to because he doesn't want them stealing his case. And Bill asks what case he's talking about because they haven't found anything about anything yet. They've just been walking around following people for multiple days, months, maybe weeks at this point. This causes everyone in the car to start yelling at each other, but we're thankfully spared having to listen to it by moving to a hotel room where Sal is having some heroin he's trying to sell tested in front of a mob boss. And then we get these really great close-up shots of the heroin being tested.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get... This movie loves to focus on, like, minute details of things and, like, things happening. So you get these close-up shots of, like, a rubber band being wound around a thermometer.
Yeah.
And then, like, bubbles in a flask and, like, tapping against glass and, like, the temperature of a thermometer slowly rising. So all these great little... Focuses on the little details of him testing the heroin. We get close-up shots of the thermometer, and then the guy who's testing it is, like, narrating the whole time, but he's just saying these nonsensical statements, like, 200, good housekeeping seal of approval, 210, U.S. government certified. And just every time the temperature reaches a new mark, he has another one of those to just throw out. The man doing the testing is happy with the results at the end, and he calls it grade A poison. Best he's ever seen. Sal says that sounds like they have a deal, but the mob boss says if he's learned one thing, it's that it never hurts to be cautious. Sal, of course, isn't happy and says if they don't hurry, the longshoreman will go back to France and make the deal somewhere else. They argue about it some more, and then we go back to Popeye as he walks down the sidewalk until, right in front of him, steps the longshoreman. And so begins another drawn-out tailing sequence that ultimately leads down into the subway. And the room this testing is happening is another visually overwhelming place. There's like these gaudy Renaissance style paintings on the wall. It's all colored. The room itself is colored very outlandishly. There's like a bunch of huge plants all around it. And then the heroin on the desk, and the mob boss asks if it's worth $2 million, and then the guy who's testing it seems to agree that it is, so we at least know the amount they're trying to sell it for. And then, yeah, Sal, the dialogue seems to indicate that he's like new or up and coming in the mob and is like trying to make a name for himself. And then the older mobster's like, you need to calm down and stop trying to make your name so quickly, yeah, or you're going to get in trouble. You got to be like, you only survive in this game if you're cautious. And then we get the another long tailing sequence of the longshoreman that goes down to the subway. I think this is the point where you fell asleep.
I think so.
Because you missed this whole song and dance they do down in the subway, where they just get like off and on the subway car like 5 or 6 times. Because the longshoreman will get on and then Gene Hackman's trying to tail him, right? So he'll get on the train and like try and look at him without looking at him and like, you know, side eye him. And then, oh, the longshoreman will get back off the train. So Gene Hackman gets back off the train and then they'll just wander around for a bit. And like the longshoreman will buy a drink at a kiosk and then he'll get back on the train and Gene Hackman will get back on the train. But then the longshoreman gets back off the train. So they do that like 5 or 6 fucking times.
Is the train moving at any point or they're just stopped at
a standstill for the entire thing? They just do that off and on thing over and over. And then at some point Gene Hackman makes a telephone call to the police station to be like, I found Frog One. Mm-hmm. I'm tailing him. You need to get some people down here. But then the longshoreman walks by him as he's talking on the phone. So he has to pretend like he's talking about something else unrelated and then hang up. And just, man, it got to a point where it's comical. Cause like they're really doing this again. They're really like doing the get on and off the train thing again. Like, holy shit.
Which, like, it would make more sense to me if they were doing it, like, at different stops. Like, it would make more sense because then it becomes so obvious that the longshoreman is being tailed. Like, unless he's a fucking moron, he would have noticed.
Yeah, it's just, after, like, the second time, it's obvious that the longshoreman knows that he's being tailed and he's just fucking with Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
But then Gene Hackman just allows himself to be messed with for, like, minutes and minutes. And it's like, your cover's blown, dude. You need to... It's just a farce at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see an argument being made for that being a strength of the movie, where it's depicting... It's not making police work sexy. It's just showing how awkward and bumbling it can actually be in real cases. But
yeah, it's either you stick to it or you don't.
Yeah. Right? And then it ultimately ends with him, the longshoreman, getting on the train like right as the door is closed so Gene Hackman can't follow him that time. And then the train departs and then the longshoreman passes by Gene Hackman and like does this little wave as he passes by. Like, yeah, he knew the whole time. And then Gene Hackman runs after the train and then throws his hat on the ground in disgust. Ah, fuck. It's another cool shot they do when the train leaves. The camera is, like, placed on the back of the train as it disappears into the tunnel. Mm. So you just get to watch Gene Hackman recede into the distance as the longshoreman escapes. Then we're with Sal in the airport as he buys a ticket to Washington and is followed by one of the feds. And this is a 70s airport where they just have, like, a kiosk with a destination above it. And you just walk up and be like, how much is a ticket to this place? And then the lady gives you the ticket and she says, now be sure to put your names on your name on both the tickets.
The thing that nobody does anymore.
Yeah. Different time. Whole different reality.
I mean, okay, that sidebar, but there are still areas in airports today that say, like, ticketing. So I'm assuming it's still possible to just go to the airport, buy a ticket if you can.
Sure, but if you're a fucking crazy person. If you want to get put on a list. That's like walking up to a ticket counter a movie theater and being like, what's good that's playing? I've seen people do that, and I turned around and ran for my life.
Like, actually?
I've actually seen people do that. I did not actually run.
Yeah.
Yes, I
figured that part.
It was a very, it was an older gentleman, so he was from a bygone era, and he just walked up and said, oh, what's playing today? What should I go and see? Like, no, that's not how this works, sir.
There are some people who like to just take their chance, you know?
Yeah, you walk up to the movie ticket and say, dealer's choice, chef's choice. Just, yeah, give me whatever you feel like. So the Fed is right behind him in the line and also buys a ticket to go to Washington. Then in Washington, Sal meets with the longshoreman and tells him that he needs a few more days. The longshoreman isn't happy and calmly says that the deal has to happen by the end of the week. He walks away, and the background, which had been blurry and unfocused up to that point, comes into focus to reveal the Fed sitting in plain view and staring at Sal through a pair of binoculars. Just like Popeye, making no attempt to hide himself, just sitting on some stone steps, just pair of binoculars up to his eyes, staring directly at Sal.
And these are supposed to be federal agents.
These are federal agents. Everyone in authority is just clown shoes. It's just 100% clown shoes in this. How do the mob know that they're being trailed? Is it the man in a trench coat with the binoculars in plain view? Then we're back on the plane as the longshoreman sits next to the hitman and tells him that their American friends are getting jumpy, but the timetable must be met. And he says that Sal sees policemen in his soup. And also, do you remember this area they were in the plane?
No, I was still asleep.
You're still asleep for this part? Okay, they go to the very back of the plane, and it's not seats going forward towards the cockpit. They're like side seats like you see on a bus.
Oh.
Yeah, I've never in my life seen seats like that on a plane. But they go to the very back and it's like bus seats. So they're like looking at each other.
I've never seen that either.
Never have I ever. There's also like...
But they're just like that at the back of the plane? Just like the back. The other seats are like the yep. ones we know nowadays?
Regular plane seats. It's just in the back it turns into a bus. And
I wonder if it's because like people, if these were not actual like seats that people could reserve, or if they were, because if they're at the back of the plane, then they're near the kitchen.
It's a lounge area.
I would think so.
Yeah, maybe. From there, we jump to the scene of an unrelated car accident as Popeye and his partner pull up to yell at the chief about the case, who yells back about how the case is blown. Bill is also there and brings up Popeye getting a cop killed again. Popeye tries to punch him, but the two are kept apart by the other cops on the scene, and the chief tells Popeye he's off the assignment. And yeah, just completely unrelated car accident. The camera keeps cutting really quickly to the corpses of the people, because it was like some young 20-somethings that like crash a sports car, and we keep getting these just like quick subliminal almost flashes of the bodies with like blood all over them and stuff. It just turns into a horror movie for a couple of minutes. It was weird. This car accident has nothing to do with anything, but it's just like, oh, here's the corpses. And then it'll go back to Pop and like, oh, nope, there's the corpses. Like, almost like the camera is a person and it doesn't want to look at them, but it can't stop itself from just glancing over it at them. The morbid curiosity. There's also this really funny part where all the cops are yelling at each other and Popeye like angrily points his finger at Bill or the chief, but he doesn't say anything. He just points and like shakes his finger at them, but silent, and just doing that but not yelling at a person just really tickled my funny bone. Cause you feel like he's about to erupt, but right. But he just doesn't say anything. He just like he's all red in the face and shaking his finger, but nothing happens. So then jump to Popeye walking through a public park. He passes by a woman pushing a baby carriage, and as he does so, a shot rings out and the woman collapses. Popeye spots the shooter on a nearby rooftop and screams at everyone to run and take cover while he presses himself against a wall and slowly makes his way towards the building where the shooter is. He makes it to the roof and finds the gun, but no shooter, at least until he peers over the edge of the roof and sees the hitman running for the nearest train. I did not realize until rewatch that the shooter was the hitman.
Right.
Popeye gives chase, but fails to get to him before the hitman boards a train. This is not the subway. There are some trains in New York you have to go downstairs to get to, some you have to go upstairs. This is an upstairs train.
Yep.
Which, I'm sure they call it something different. Is like that...
Tramway?
Tramway, or just train, and then the one underground is the subway.
Yeah.
Probably. It took me a minute to like try and think of what they would call the upstairs train. So he doesn't get him before he boards the train. I think he's like on the wrong side of the tracks when he gets up there, and he's Popeye's like yelling at the people on the train to not take off because there's a criminal on there, but there's so much noise everywhere there that they don't hear him, and it just takes off.
Yeah, that's where I woke up.
Yeah.
Jeez, I missed a lot.
Popeye does... Did you, though?
Yeah, that was sarcastic.
Yeah. Popeye does find out where the next stop is, though, and borrows a car from a random civilian so he can make it to the next stop first. He just...
Which is, like, completely unrealistic. Like, how the fuck are you gonna make it there by car before the train? Like, no.
Yeah.
No.
And to get this car, he just runs out into the middle of the street and just yells at passersby, and like two or three cars go by him without stopping until he finally just stands in front of one so it would have to run him over. And then just like, I'm a cop, I need this for police business. And the guy's like, when am I going to get my car back? And then Gene Hackman just takes off. I wouldn't fucking stop for somebody to stand in the middle of the road.
No, even if it was a cop.
Yeah, even if they got a badge, screw you.
Sorry, but...
Because I know you would never, ever see that car again.
No.
And they're not going to give you money for it or anything. That car just fall into the void.
I mean, technically they should, but how are they going to... I answer my own question. They would know where to find you with your license plate.
Yeah.
And go through the DMV.
No. Uh-uh. We are at a point in our society where I don't care if you have a badge. You're not getting my car.
Because you're going to wreck it.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
I'm never going to see that car again, and you're not going to give me any money for it. You got a badge that makes me trust you less. Back on the train, things aren't going great for the hitman, who has been noticed by a guard who wants to see a ticket that the hitman does not have. And the hitman tries to get away by just, like, walking away to the next train car. But the guard follows him and yells at him to stop. But instead, the hitman turns around and shoots the guard and then makes his way to the conductor, who he holds at gunpoint and tells to not stop at the next station. This was an incredibly unprofessional plan, I would call it. Like, this is just a mess. Like, A, shooting Popeye in broad daylight and missing. Then just running onto a train with no plan, and then you shoot the first guard who asks you a question, and then you take the conductor hostage. Like, every step of this plan was not thought out, and then just escalates to the next level of insanity. This,
but at the same, if you're a hitman, do you think about buying a ticket for the train?
Yes! If I was gonna fucking kill somebody, I would meticulously plot out every possible scenario. I would not wing it like this guy is.
I guess.
I certainly wouldn't have left my gun on the rooftop. I wouldn't have shot the first guard who asked me a question. And I would not have taken the conductor of the train hostage.
Okay. Let's think of it that way. He's a hitman.
Yep.
He was not planning on missing. So I'm assuming that if he had not missed... The gun would have left with him.
Sure.
He's taken by surprise here because he misses, and then Popeye, you know...
Makes it to the roof.
Yeah, makes it to the roof. So he has to leave in a hurry. His whole plan probably just shatters because here's an unexpected situation. You fucking missed.
I understand all that. It's just that every action he takes makes it, like, exponentially worse.
I know. I completely understand that. I'm saying, like, there was probably... Most likely a plan in place. Like, you see that in the first scene in Friends when he kills that guy in the hallway of the building.
Yeah, he's waiting for him.
He's waiting for him. He's so calm. So there's nothing that shakes this guy. And then here he is. He's got an assignment and fucking misses. Like, that's probably the first time he...
We don't even know if it's an assignment. We don't know if the longshoreman told him to do this, or if he just went rogue on his own and decided to take care of the problem. Why he chose to use a sniper rifle this time when the first guy he killed was, like, up close and personal with a pistol.
I would say a good rule of thumb is that hitmen usually kill for money.
Yeah. We don't know what his relationship is to the longshoreman. Is that why he's with the longshoreman? So he can take care of people that need to be taken care of? We don't know.
Yeah.
The movie tells us nothing.
All I'm saying is this is just probably a fluke.
Yeah. Then we cut back to Popeye, who has made it to the next station ahead of the hitman just in time to see the train blow past without stopping. Rat shit. Back to the car he goes, and then this whole time, it's a chase sequence, but it's really just like 7 minutes of close-up shots of Gene Hackman like wrestling with a steering wheel and just honking at everybody and constant tire screeching, and he crashes into another car at one point because he's like going the wrong way in traffic, you know, normal car chase stuff. And then he like plows through a bunch of boxes. He has to swerve to avoid another woman pushing a baby carriage. And he like plows through a bunch of boxes stacked on top of each other. I don't remember where I saw this, but I caught some whiff somewhere of a comment that this is like one of the most iconic car chases ever.
Yeah.
And I guess I have to preface this by saying I'm not really a huge fan of car chases to begin with, and like it's not bad, but I would love to hear the explanation for what makes this stand out from any other car chase.
Yeah, I honestly don't know.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure they are incredibly logistically difficult to film. And it's a whole fucking thing, and you've only got really one attempt to do it because the car is going to be so beat up afterwards. So it's impressive from a technical perspective, but like actually watching it as entertainment, it's just like he's going faster than he should, and he occasionally bumps into stuff. I sleep. On the train, things continue to get worse as more guards show up, and the hitman shoots another one. He then sees a stopped train they're barreling towards and tells the conductor to stop, but the conductor has either died or passed out from the stress, and the train crashes. And not the first train crash we've seen in this project, but I would say probably the most underwhelming one.
Yeah.
You get another interesting camera shot where they just position the camera like on the front of the barreling train, so it goes like right up into the back of the stop train, but then you don't get any far shot of the train coming off tracks or anything. I think they're doing some editing magic to make it look like it crashed without actually having to crash a train or show a crash train. It's like, take our word for it, it crashed. Popeye has managed to keep up with the train though, and sees the hitman stumble from the wreckage and try to go downstairs to street level. Popeye is at the bottom of those stairs with a gun, though, and yells at the hitman to hold it. The hitman does not hold it and turns around to run, only to be shot in the back and tumble down the stairs, landing in a broken heap next to Popeye, who has also collapsed on the stairs. That was the scene on the poster.
Yeah.
The hitman being shot in the back. I would have taken the shot of them both crumpled at the foot of the stairs. That would have been a better shot for the poster. Next stop is an all-night stakeout where Popeye and partner watch a car Sal parked somewhere because it has to be dirty, says Popeye. Didn't they get taken off the case? Why are they still doing this?
Well, at least Popeye was taken off the case, not the partner.
They sit and watch the car until 4 a.m., at which point they see some people approaching the car and rush over, sirens blaring and guns shooting in the air, only to find out it was some random street goons trying to steal the tires of the car. So
they get suspicious because they see that same car coming by multiple times.
Yeah, they're like, oh, these guys have been by four times now. They're just circling. And there's also some kids playing street hockey with an empty soda can underneath a streetlight.
Yep.
On actual roller skates, just down the street. There's so much nonsensical detail in this movie. Now we'll get to it at the end. So they blow their cover too soon. It's not the people they actually wanted. And then Popeye is not happy about this and throws out a racial slur. And then tells them to haul the car away so they can tear it apart looking for drugs anyway. So it doesn't even matter that they didn't get the right people. Cut.
Which is another, like, that would not happen. Like, you need, in real life, you need probable cause to take that car away.
I don't think Popeye needs anything. Popeye doesn't even show his badge to people. Popeye is the law. We then cut to an extended sequence of Popeye, his partner, and an old mechanic we've never seen before tearing the car apart. you get shots of them like ripping the carpet up.
Yeah, they're
tearing it to pieces.
This is an extreme detailing.
They're taking the radio apart and like the ashtray. There's just dust coming out of everything. And you get another great shot where the camera's positioned like underneath the car as it gets picked up by a lift.
Mm-hmm.
And as it moves up out of the shot, it reveals Gene Hackman just sitting against the wall. So he's slowly uncovered by the shadow of the car as it rises up. After hours of work, the mechanic tells Popeye that there's nothing to be found, but Popeye doesn't buy it. Then you find it, replies the mechanic, because I can't. Then we see Henry in the garage, annoyed and trying to get his car back. He demands its return. And Henry has, like, this minder or like, a translator who's always with him.
Yeah, because Henry doesn't speak English.
Yeah. And so the translator, you don't understand. This is very important. He's a celebrity. He needs his car back. If you don't want to be part of his next film, you'll get the car back.
Yeah. Or it's not that he doesn't speak English. He doesn't speak very good English.
Yeah, not enough to be negotiating with cops. And we're back to tearing apart the car. And the partner lazily asks what the car weighed when it was brought in. 4,795 pounds, says the mechanic. The owner's manual says it's supposed to be 4,675, replies the partner. It's 120 pounds overweight. Popeye has to be right. Look, guys, says the mechanic. I ripped everything out but the rocker panels. Popeye yells at the mechanic. Come on, I looked everywhere except for one place, guys. Come on. And then Popeye's like, you fucking... the rocker panels are then removed, and the rocker panels are just the inside of the door frame on the bottom.
Yeah.
It's like where you would step if you were stepping into a car.
Yeah.
So those are removed, and the heroin is found. They were stuffed inside there. But then put back, and the car is returned to Henry, which I call bullshit on, because they ripped that thing to fucking pieces.
Yeah, there's no way they put that car back.
No. Like,
no fucking way.
They were ripping the carpets out of the floor. Yeah. Like, no. No, sir. Then we jump to the lobby of a fancy hotel, where Henry meets with a longshoreman, who asks too many questions about whether Henry was followed, making Henry suspicious, because at this point we learn that Henry does not know any of the details of what's going on. He just thinks he's in America, having a fun trip.
Yeah.
The longshoreman tries to soothe him by saying if he plays along, there's more money in it for him, but Henry isn't having it and walks away. After that, we join the longshoreman as he drives to make the deal in an abandoned warehouse. All of the mob guys are there. They all have to come out for the deal, which is stupid. But what are you going to do? And we watch the drugs get slowly removed from the car and tested. Tested by, like, putting a little drop of liquid in a little bit of it and seeing if the liquid turns a certain color. And I thought...
Certain color and a certain temperature, I think.
Yeah. And I thought that what was going to happen is that they had replaced the drugs with, like, flour or something. And so it was going to test negative and they were all going to turn on each other and then start shooting. But it tests out fine. They just put the real drugs back in the car. The test shows it's good, and several briefcases full of money are given to the longshoreman.
I would say, like, they have to put the drugs back in the car because otherwise, like... when they're finally making the bust, if it's not the real drugs, then that could be a dismissed trial.
Yeah, I didn't understand why they were giving the car back at first. I was like, you found the drugs, make the arrest. But I get now that they were trying to get them to lead them back to the bigger fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to catch them in action.
In the act, yep. That could be anybody's car. So they give it back to him and then follow him, yep. The money is then stashed in the same place the drugs were hidden, and everyone leaves celebrating a well-done trade. Sal and his brother are, like, hooting and hollering and slapping each other on the back. Oh, we did it! I'll see you at Pops tonight for dinner! Oh, I love you! I love you, too! Yay! I love not being in jail! Sal gets in the car with the longshoreman, and they drive away. They come over the crest of a bridge... and see the road ahead completely blocked by cop cars. it's good because you're seeing from their same perspective, so mm-hmm. you get the reveal too as they come over the crest, and it's just the entire road blocked off.
Like, surprise!
Yep. Surprise, motherfucker. Popeye walks in front of the cars and waves at the longshoreman the same way the longshoreman waved at Popeye on the subway. He does the same, like, small little wave the guy did. Sal then does the stupidest thing imaginable and turns the car around and drives back to the group of mobsters at the warehouse, leading them right back to him. All the mob guys scatter as the police arrive, and Popeye takes off after the longshoreman, leaving the rest of the cops to get in a shootout with the mobsters who are holed up in the warehouse. Popeye follows the longshoreman into what can only be described as a cave/dungeon and slowly stalks him through the ruined environment. This place, man, there is no place in this movie that is clean, but this is by far the most dilapidated, rundown thing they go into. It is an abandoned building where it's just been left to go to seed, to the point where, like, all the paint has peeled off the walls, like, doors are broken off their frames, there's just dirt all over the floor.
Yeah,
there's,
it's mostly just, like, walls and like, puddles of, like, mud.
Everything is damp. There's, like, mold everywhere. It's just, it's what happens to a building when humans don't take care of it.
Right.
It shows some, like, toilets that are broken in half at some point. There's just constantly water dripping from the ceiling. Like, this place is a fucking cave. At some point, his partner joins him, and Popeye tells him that the longshoreman is in the room right in front of them. Frog One is in there, he says. They move forward together until Popeye sees a silhouette in a doorway in front of them and empties his gun into it. They approach and discover that Popeye has not shot the longshoreman, but instead has murdered one of the federal agents. I thought this was Bill the first time.
I thought so too.
But I think it's one of the agents. They look exactly alike, but they call him by the agent's name, and I think they would have said Bill if it was Bill. And I thought that was, like, the irony that Bill kept bringing up the cop he had gotten killed, and then he was another one that Popeye killed, but that's not the case, I don't think. It's hard to tell them apart. Because anyone aside from Gene Hackman is just not a character in this movie. Popeye then reloads his gun and says he'll still get the son of a bitch and runs off to another room. He disappears from view of the camera around a corner and a single gunshot rings out. Cut to black. Then still images of characters and their fates. The mob boss, Joel Weinstock, was indicted by a grand jury. The case was dismissed for lack of evidence. Angie Boca was charged with a misdemeanor, sentence suspended. Lou Boca was guilty of conspiracy and possession of narcotics, sentence reduced. Henry Devereaux, guilty of conspiracy, served 4 years in a federal penitentiary.
Yeah.
Henry is the only one that gets charged from all this.
Yeah.
They don't mention Sal because Sal gets gunned down and dies in the firefight. The longshoreman was never caught. It is believed he is living in France. And finally, Popeye and his partner were transferred out of the Narcotics Bureau and reassigned. The end. What an abrupt ending. He runs off camera. You hear a gunshot. And he's like, all right, here's what happened to everybody. Nobody went to jail and they escaped.
And I was like, what?
Yeah.
This is what we get after, granted, this movie's not, you know, super long, but even after, like, what, an hour and 40 minutes? I'm like, what the fuck? We deserve better.
It felt longer than it was. Yeah. I didn't mind it for most of it, but the last 20 minutes, it really started to drag for me. Yeah, might be the most abrupt ending we've had so far in this project.
Yeah.
Just gunshot, cut to black, here's what happened to everybody. Like, yeah. Yeah, so let's actually get into it.
I wonder if they just, like, didn't know how to end it, or if it's...
If this is based on real events, that's what actually happened.
Yeah.
So they had to make an ending out of what they had.
Yeah.
And this... Like I pointed to with my alternate title for this movie, this whole movie just feels like a dream.
I honestly think after like doing research for the like fun fact notes and stuff like that, I honestly think that the director just wanted to make the movie just as like a visual project.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, cuz the cinematography is amazing.
Yeah.
The all the different kinds of shots they get of bridges and of the smoke-filled streets and the storefronts and the people, it is just
all the camera like work they had to do for those chases and all that. Like, yeah, it's definitely innovative in a way that we hadn't seen in a while.
You could watch this movie a dozen times and see something new every single time you watch it. There is just, it is one of the most visually overwhelming movies I have ever seen.
Yeah.
Just stuffed. Every single scene is just stuffed with overwhelming clutter and detail.
Stuffed, but beautiful at the same time. It definitely, like you said at the beginning, it feels like there's, every shot is very intentional. It has been planned to like the millimeter. Yep. And it's, you can see all the, you can imagine all the work that went into planning for shooting each scene.
Yeah. The actual story itself is barely even a story.
Yeah.
It's barely even characters. And just, I know I've called other things surreal and dreamlike, like the end of On the Waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not calling this dreamlike because it was surreal in any way. It's just the amount of random details that happen in this that just are unconnected and have nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
Feels like how you jump around randomly in a dream. It's like you can feel someone trying to explain, like this feels like someone trying to explain a dream they had. Like there was a lady with red boots and then I had sex with the lady and then we tore the car apart and then there was a French guy and he ate a potato out of a puddle on the sidewalk and then there was some kids playing hockey in the street and then we tried to arrest the guy but it was the wrong guy and then there was a shootout and then I fired my gun at him and then I woke up so I don't even know what happened. Like it just feels like that.
Yeah.
Now,
I can see that.
And we tore the car apart, and we didn't find anything, and then I just watched the bad guy just eat food for 10 minutes. Yeah. Like, I didn't hate it, but also just, yeah, it just feels more like a visual piece of art than a story.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, it feels like the director chose to make it just like as a visual experiment.
It almost feels like in the way that like paintings in a museum, you wouldn't call those entertainment, right? They're just art.
Yeah.
It's something for you to look at.
Yeah.
And it's pretty. But like,
but you're not supposed to walk away from it having learned anything.
No. Gene Hackman gave a great performance. But like, there's no characters and then just like they're randomly getting shot at on the rooftop and then the entire extended like chase sequence with the train. Yeah, I didn't hate it, but I don't love it either. It's, how do you feel about it?
I feel like I'm where you are too. Is like I almost want to like rewatch it without sound and just look at the, you know, not get distracted by everything that happens in the background.
By all like, the talking of Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, by all the talking and all the dramatic music. And just focus on just the images. Because I feel like it's, I almost feel like that's the way it's supposed to be watched. It feels like it could be a silent movie and it would still make some sort of sense.
Yeah. With as little detail and explanation as it gives you about anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can glean everything that's possible to glean by just watching it.
Yeah. But the story itself, like, I don't care for it. B, there's not enough that's given to us as audience to make sense out of any of it.
No, like, who the fuck was the guy who got killed in the beginning? You can extrapolate that he's involved in the drug trade in some way, but, like, you need to tell me that movie.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to guess.
Yeah. I would say it just maybe just a scene to establish the hitman as a hitman.
Yeah, which didn't even, I get, there's so many people in this movie that look alike, it's really hard to tell one cop from another.
Yeah.
When they don't give them names and no one has audible dialogue. So, yeah. I think I'll remember it, though, more than I remember other stuff we've watched.
I don't think I'm going to remember the movie as a whole, but there are definitely scenes that were more striking than others.
Yeah, I'll remember what it was more than the actual details of it.
Yeah.
Just the whole dreamlike quality of it and the visual traffic jam. Best movie we've watched in the 70s so far. I would certainly watch this over Patton again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
And like, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I love time capsule movies, and man, that was just walking around 70s New York for like almost 2 hours, seeing all the beauty of it there is to see. Even trash can be beautiful. There's such a like lack of consequence for anything, which adds to the dreamlike quality, like him shooting the federal agent. Like, his partner acknowledges, like, you shot him, but there's like...
Yeah, there's no panic there. There's no. Which, I mean, it's all,
there's almost no reaction. And, like, you'd think he'd be thrown off the fucking police force for killing a federal agent, but they just transfer him somewhere
else. He was reassigned.
Reassigned, yeah.
And maybe enough of a slap.
I guess.
At the time.
Fuck. Yeah, and he gets taken off the case, but then just the next scene, he's just working it again. Like, there's no... Just consequent just doesn't exist. And that traffic, the car chase, he just, like, destroys a bunch of civilian cars and, like, is a public menace.
You don't understand. The movie doesn't have time to get into this minutia of details that...
Yeah. He's a loose cannon, but he gets results. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's like, it's a movie that wants to show you what it's like to be a cop, but it doesn't want to go into all the details.
To be a cowboy, you do not see anyone's badge in this entire movie.
Yeah.
Popeye just shows up, says he's a cop, and then just beats the shit out of anyone he wants to. And then yells at him about picking their feet.
In Poughkeepsie.
Now pick your feet, Poughkeepsie. Where's it going on your list?
Well, we just said that we would watch it again over Patton.
And Patton's number 20.
At the same time, like, Patton made more sense in many ways.
I would watch this over Patton.
I know. I'm just pointing out some inconsistencies.
You do whatever you need to do. You go with God. I would watch this in a heartbeat again over Patton. You could probably watch this twice before watching Patton once with this runtime.
Well, it's not better than Ben-Hur, so...
Right above Patton?
So it's going to go right above Patton for me.
Just so we're not liars.
Yeah. Yeah.
So your new number 21.
Right.
Which we've got 42 movies on the list now, so that is dead center.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, actually, no, because here's you see. Oh, yeah. They're both 43. 21. So, oh, yeah.
43. As center as you can be with an odd number.
Yep. What about you?
Number one. No. Better than Patton, which is my current 25. Was it better than All Quiet on the Western Front? Ooh. No, I don't think it is. So right above Patton for me, too. My new number 25. You like this movie better than I did.
Yeah, it's a hard sell, though.
Well, hold on.
Okay.
I'm rethinking this. We haven't gotten it down yet, because it's better than The Great Ziegfeld, and it's better than The Life of Emile Zola.
Better than The Life of Emile Zola?
I'd say so.
What?
That movie was boring. It was entirely in a courtroom.
J'accuse.
Yes, they said the thing. Is it better than Mutiny on the Bounty? I think it is. Is it better From Here to Eternity? Yeah, it's not better than Wings, though. So, new number 20 for me. An 11th hour save. So, 21 for you, 20 for me.
Yeah.
I liked it better.
It's hard. Okay, I will say that again. It's hard sometimes to figure out where to put these movies on the list because, like, this one, if you were just going by, like, technical achievement and all that, it would score so fucking high.
Yep.
But there's all these things that about just the story and how it drags and all that, like, that you can't ignore when deciding where to put it on the list. So
it's a very lopsided movie.
Yeah.
It put all its money into the cinematography, and everything else suffers because of it.
Yeah.
Yep. 20 for me, 21 for you. What's our next movie?
Is The Godfather.
It's The Godfather. Oh boy. Another big long one.
That would be a first viewing for me.
Second for me.
I've never watched The Godfather.
Finally watching a movie that other people will have heard of.
Yeah.
The Godfather. Part one. Yep. And then, is Godfather 2 the year right after? Or do we take a break from it?
I don't think so. I think we take a break. There's a couple years break between the two of them.
The first and only sequel that we'll see on the Best Picture.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming. Yeah, we're starting to enter into a real murderer's row because we've got The Godfather, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest is 75, and I think Rocky is 76.
Yeah.
So we're getting into some real good, recognizable, iconic stuff.
Yeah. Staying in New York.
Yep. Yeah, that's another thing I wanted to mention is that there's this juxtaposition in the movies that win Best Picture. You either get the, like, super clean, super fancy, like, high society, like, we're in a ballroom with chandeliers and dresses and tiles, or the complete opposite, where you're wandering around, like, the moldy, filthy streets of New York.
Mm.
Like, it's either you're in paradise, or you're in, like, the slums.
Right.
Like, there's no middle ground. They just, the Academy Awards, the visual extremes.
Sorry, I was caught up in looking at the years. And yeah, Godfather is 72, and then Godfather 2 is 74.
We get the Sting in between.
Yep.
It feels like we're getting into a real, like, crime.
Yeah, crime and craziness.
Crime and mafia.
Yeah.
Binge here. Then The Deer Hunter and Annie. Oh, what is this? Is Annie Hall a musical?
It might be.
Did we overdose on crime and then we...
I need to get an antidote.
We have to sober up with Annie Hall in 77. Ugh. Star Wars lost in... Goodbye. That's the end of the episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Disgusting.
Bye.
Okay, that's it.